KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We focused on those who are severely damaged, who are ill, young people.
There's no deal to end the war, but Ukraine and Russia agreed to a prisoner swap after the latest peace talks.
For Monday, June 2nd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, how President Trump's military parade fits into American history.
He's really reinventing the presidency as something that doesn't resemble what it has traditionally in American history, and the military parade is part of that.
Later, the FBI's new director is making big changes.
What a new Polish president means for Europe.
And how people in North Carolina are rebuilding from Hurricane Helene.
I do see a little bit of hope, but not the hope that I would have thought during this whole process. It's still one day at a time, one breath at a time.
Plus, this week's My Unsung Hero is the story of a blood donor.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Authorities say the man who has been charged with launching a weekend attack in Boulder, Colorado, that left 12 people injured there, had been planning it for a year, targeting what he called a Zionist group. The FBI has identified the suspect as 45-year-old Mohammed Sabri Soleiman. Speaking at a news conference, acting U.S. Attorney for the District of Colorado, J. Bishop Gruhl, described Sunday's attack.
What the charges allege that he did was to throw Molotov cocktails at a group of men and women, some of them in their late 80s, burning them as they peacefully walked on a Sunday to draw attention to Israeli hostages held in Gaza.
Administration officials say Soleiman, an Egyptian citizen, is one of 500,000 people estimated to have overstayed his tourist visa and, according to DHS, was in the U.S. illegally. Indiana Governor Mike Braun has replaced the alumni-elected trustees of Indiana University with his own picks, including several polarizing conservative figures. Ethan Sandweiss from member station WFIU has more.
Last-minute changes to the state budget allow the governor to remove the three elected trustees, although Braun previously told reporters he wasn't considering it. The governor notified them they were terminated in a one-sentence letter. The new trustees include conservative attorney James Bopp Jr., who represented Citizens United in a court case that opened the door for corporate political spending. Bopp has also challenged the results of the 2020 presidential election. Governor Mike Braun also appointed former ESPN anchor Stage Steele, who was suspended from the network in 2021 after comments against COVID vaccine mandates and about former President Barack Obama's racial identity. For NPR News, I'm Ethan Sandweiss in Bloomington, Indiana.
Over the weekend, the oil-producing members of OPEC Plus announced they're increasing production, the kind of news that usually sends prices down, but not this time. NPR's Camila Domonoske explains.
It's Econ 101. If supply's up and demand hasn't changed, prices drop. And for months now, OPEC Plus, the group of oil-producing countries led by Saudi Arabia, has announced it's putting more oil on global markets, and global prices have dropped. But now it's a pattern. OPEC announced the same production hike 3 months in a row. So this time, the oil market was expecting it, already pricing it in. Add some geopolitical concerns to the mix, and prices went up instead. Econ 101 is useful, but the real world's a good bit more complicated. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
The Trump administration's announcement last week it intends to double tariffs on foreign steel and aluminum may hit Americans in unexpected places, including the grocery store aisle. That's because the 50% levy Trump announced on imports would affect big-ticket items like washing machines and cars, but also packaging for things like soup and nuts. You're listening to NPR News. Israeli forces in Gaza apparently opened fire again as a group of people were headed to an aid distribution site, killing at least three people and wounding dozens more. That's according to Gaza health officials. Military there says it fired warning shots at suspects who approached its forces. The shooting taking place at the same location where Israeli forces fired a day earlier on crowds of people headed for an aid hub in southern Gaza. An exercise program for colon cancer survivors can cut their risk of dying by a third. NPR's Maria Godoy has more on the findings of a first-of-its-kind trial.
The study involved 889 patients who had completed chemotherapy. Half were given information promoting fitness and nutrition. The other half worked with a coach in a structured exercise program over 3 years. After 8 years, patients in the structured exercise program had a 28% lower risk of their cancer coming back. Over the years, lots of research has shown that colon cancer survivors who are more physically active have a lower risk of recurrence and improved overall survival compared to those who exercise less. But the new study is the first randomized controlled trial to find similar improvements. The findings appear in the New England Journal of Medicine. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Sicily's Mount Etna has rumbled to life, putting on a fiery show and sending tourists fleeing. Though officials say while volcanic activity sent a cloud of smoke and ash into the air, it poses no danger to the population. Alert level was raised at the Catania Airport today. Representatives at Italy's National Institute of Geophysics and Volcanology say the spectacle was caused when part of a southeast crater collapsed. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Officials from Russia and Ukraine met for a second round of peace negotiations in Istanbul today. The discussions come after a surprise Ukrainian drone attack on remote Russian air bases yesterday. We'll have more on the Ukrainian drone operation later in the program. First, to tell us more about these latest diplomatic efforts to end the war in Ukraine, NPR's Charles Maines joins us from Moscow. Charles, did today's negotiations actually accomplish anything?
Well, both sides were supposed to present their so-called memoranda. These are essentially written proposals outlining their vision for a future peace accord. That happened, but not without some gamesmanship from the Russian delegation, which refused to share a draft in advance of the meeting, which Kyiv, in fact, had done. Either way, these peace proposals didn't seem to get very far. The two sides only met for about an hour. But you can't say this meeting was pointless. Far from it. Ukraine's lead negotiator, Defense Minister Rustem Umerov, said the two sides agreed to a range of humanitarian exchanges, in effect building on a mass prisoner exchange that came out of the previous round of negotiations. Here's Umerov.
We focused on those who are severely damaged, who are ill. We focus on the categories of the young people and another categories and exchanges of the bodies of the people who died.
Well, if that's what the Ukrainian side said, did Russia confirm that the prisoner swaps will happen?
They did. Russia's lead negotiator, Kremlin aide Vladimir Medinsky, put more details on this. He announced that Russia agreed to return the remains of 6,000 Ukrainian soldiers. Medinsky suggested he didn't know if there were presumed Russian dead held by the Ukrainian side as well, but said Moscow would accept them too if so. Medinsky also announced an exchange of all prisoners in poor health and for all POWs under the age of 25. But it's not clear what that means. Let's remember that in Ukraine, the draft age is 25, though, of course, younger people have also joined in the fight.
Another issue that the Ukrainians said they intended to raise was children kidnapped in Ukraine by the Russian army and brought into Russia. Was there any progress on that?
Well, the Ukrainians brought the issue up, and Medinsky, the lead Russian negotiator, made something of a show of it. So in front of reporters, Medinsky pulled out a list of more than 300 children he said Ukraine had presented to Russia that Kyiv wanted returned. But Medinsky went on to suggest Ukraine was amplifying the issue of missing children and vastly the numbers of them to garner sympathy in the West. Either the way, Medinsky said Russia would investigate and return any minors to families indeed seeking them.
These minor issues don't seem to address whether there will be an end to the war, something that Trump has been pushing for hard. What is the holdup?
Well, the problem is the Trump administration is finding out is that neither side is ready to accept where things stand right now on the front lines. Russia, despite participating in these talks, has almost shown zero willingness to compromise. You know, it still essentially demands control over Ukraine and thinks its advantage on the battlefield means it can achieve it. which is why these surprise drone attacks by Ukraine on Sunday on Russian air bases were important. You know, they seem time to show Russia and Trump that Ukraine still has plenty of fight left in it. And given that, it was interesting to see one small, I suppose, compromise from the Russian delegation today. Medinsky said Russia had suggested staggered short-term ceasefires, 2 or 3 days along the front line, but maybe not for the reason you might think, not as a step towards peace. Medinsky described it as a question of sanitation in the hot summer months, so each side could collect the dead.
That is NPR's Charles Maines reporting from Moscow. Thank you.
Thank you.
A new Atlantic hurricane season is now underway, but in North Carolina, communities are still struggling to recover from last year and the destruction from Hurricane Helene. Helene's flooding and high winds damaged or destroyed more than 100,000 homes, wiping out whole communities. NPR's Greg Allen reports 8 months later, many still can't find temporary housing.
In the town of Swannanoa before Helene, the Super 8 Motel, just a few hundred yards from the river, provided affordable short- and long-term housing for dozens of people. Now it's like a scene from a post-apocalyptic movie. Kim Meisch's father lived here.
We're looking at rooms shifted off, cars open, mud, debris everywhere, insulation hanging from the ceilings. Room 222 was my dad's room.
Last September, when Helene hit western North Carolina, heavy rains forced rivers and tributaries out of their banks, causing the worst flooding seen in more than two centuries. The Swannanoa River flooded much of the town. Meisch lives not far from the motel and was up most of the night watching the river rise and worrying about her father.
He stood and there was water in his room. His trash can floated right by him, and that's when he had the National Guard knocking on his door.
Everyone got out of the motel safely. Her father has since found another place to live. Most of the others who are living there still haven't found new homes. Meisch now is working with Swannanoa Communities Together, a group formed by local residents after the storm to focus on the area's greatest need, finding an affordable place to live. She's been helping residents put their lives back together with the help of FEMA and private aid groups.
I still see heartbreak. I do see a little bit of hope, but not the hope that I would have thought. During this whole process, it's still one day at a time, one breath at a time.
8 months after the storm in Swannanoa, Black Mountain, Asheville, and other communities throughout western North Carolina, evidence of Helene's destruction is everywhere. Buildings sit damaged and vacant. Downed trees and piles of debris still wait to be cleared. But for many people, the most pressing problem remains finding an affordable place to live. Even before the storm, there was a housing shortage.
Pre-Helene, we had a vacancy rate on rentals at like 1.2%. So 98.8% of our housing rental units were occupied.
Jen Hampton is with Just Economics, a nonprofit that advocates for government policies that help address wage and housing issues. Sitting outside of her office in Asheville, she said in the 20 years she's lived there, she's seen it become a major destination for visitors, retirees, and remote workers. It's raised housing costs dramatically.
We have quite a few illegal Airbnbs operating within city limits. And paired with that, we also have the highest cost of living in the state and also some of the lowest average wages.
Helene's flooding and wind damaged homes and apartment buildings, and it wrecked Asheville's tourism and service-based economy. Housing advocates wanted the state to impose an emergency moratorium on evictions, but were unsuccessful.
There are a lot of people living in their cars. There's a lot of people about to be evicted or being threatened with eviction. And we can't build more housing fast enough, and we can't build enough affordable housing fast enough.
Now it's residents who are stepping up with possible solutions to the housing crisis.
This is West Asheville. The mobile home park is called Mosswood, and it's one of the largest mobile home parks here in the Emma community.
Kelvin Bonilla is with Poder Emma, a community group that helps people buy and maintain affordable homes. Emma is a hilly, wooded area near Asheville, where there are dozens of mobile home communities. The homes here are affordable, but many are 50 and 60 years old and need work.
¿Qué onda, chicos?
Bonilla checks in on a crew that's replacing a deck on an aging mobile home. Since Helene, crews have repaired roofs, cleared down trees, and installed new insulated siding on dozens of mobile homes. Andrea Golden, Poder Emma's co-director, says the work done at no cost to homeowners allows people to stay in their houses.
There is absolutely nothing else that is able to meet the level of affordability that mobile homes do.
Poder has helped residents form cooperatives that in several cases have been able to buy the land their homes sit on. Owning the land allows them to build equity in their homes and create long-term stable communities. Golden says local officials have to revise old views on mobile homes and the people who live in them.
Local governments were trying to zone us out of mobile homes and mobile home parks for years. Although now, I think with the affordable housing crisis, the conversation has changed some. But I think there's a lot of myths and stereotypes about mobile homes.
Golden says in communities where residents own the land, mobile homes can become permanent, long-term housing. But a lot depends on where they're located. In the town of Swannanoa, people drowned in communities near the river that were overwhelmed in Helene's flooding. It's left many former mobile home residents searching for housing. Beth Trigg with Swannanoa Communities Together says some people went through the winter living in sheds.
To me, those are a symptom of the fact that the housing crisis is ongoing, because it doesn't really work for most people to live in a 10 by 10 uninsulated structure. It's like one step up from a tent.
Trigg and other activists working on the housing crisis are thankful to nonprofits and charities that have stepped in. But she and other activists are frustrated that local, state, and federal government are devoting so little attention to long-term housing needs.
Policy tends to center around like rebuilding roads and bridges and small business loans and many other things that are very important. And housing is kind of an afterthought. And for us, we think housing needs to be the first thing we think about.
In Swannanoa, before the storm, Paulina Hernandez and her husband used their savings to buy and rent out several mobile homes in a small community near the river.
Hourglass Way.
Hourglass Way. There was mostly mobile homes here.
It's a 9 mobile home here. So we own it 7. My son living here, my daughter living in the second one.
The mobile homes were all destroyed in the flood. Returning to the site with visitors, she becomes emotional.
Everything gone. We don't have a house. My son and my daughter. Everybody's safe.
That's the positive note Hernandez holds on to. Everyone got out safely, even a neighbor who refused to evacuate but later was rescued from his rooftop. With the help of Swannanoa Communities Together, she and her family have found a temporary apartment. But with another hurricane season now underway, like many recovering from Helene, she and her husband are still searching for long-term housing. If the landowner agrees to have them back, she says they hope to eventually begin rebuilding their small mobile home community here on Hourglass Way. Greg Allen, NPR News, Swannanoa, North Carolina.
The story was produced by NPR senior producer Marisa Pinalosa.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG. Our purpose is people. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The U.S. Army is getting a birthday party this month. The Army was established on June 14th, 250 years ago. So a military parade will march through the streets of Washington on that day, which also happens to be President Trump's 79th birthday. This kind of procession has been on Trump's wish list since his first term, with troops in uniform, tanks, and howitzers rolling through the streets. The Army says its bill for the birthday celebration and parade could be up to $45 million, and the total public costs could be higher. The Capitol has not seen a military parade like this in decades, so for some perspective on where this fits into American tradition, I'm joined by historian Joshua Zeitz. He's a contributing editor for Politico magazine. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
When was the last big military parade like the one planned in D.C. for this month?
That would have been 1991 to mark the end of the first Gulf War. And even at the time, it was seen as being somewhat of a break with American tradition. There was a fairly heated debate within George H.W. Bush's administration as to whether it was appropriate. And ultimately, the president determined that it would help Americans get over the so-called Vietnam syndrome to be able to celebrate, a victorious army.
When the U.S. has had military parades like that one, whether it was 1991 or stretching all the way back to the Civil War, you note that they marked military victories.
That's exactly right. There's a long tradition in American history, and certainly with the founding generation, which viewed with a lot of skepticism the idea that kings or parliament should keep permanent militaries, long so-called standing armies. And so the instances in which we did have large military parades, it came at the end of wars, and it celebrated the demobilization of large armies. So that would have been 1865, right after the Civil War, 1919 after World War I, 1945 after World War II. These never occurred during peacetime.
But there are a couple exceptions. John F. Kennedy, Dwight Eisenhower both had parades with troops and weaponry to mark their inaugurations. Even so, Trump is receiving criticism for this parade beyond the cost for the message it's sending. So what do you see as the problem with this parade that the president has planned?
You raise a good point. I mean, prior presidents have used military regalia to celebrate or mark other moments. There are obviously military ceremonies that happen, for instance, at Arlington National Cemetery on Memorial Day. There's a military presence at inaugurations, but that's very different from what we're doing here. This is something that you would expect to see in countries like North Korea or the old Soviet Union or today's Russia, where, you know, strongmen effectively paraded their military and its equipment in an effort to intimidate perceived enemies abroad and at home. This feels much more like that than it does the large-scale military parades that occurred after the Civil War or World Wars I and II, not only celebrating a victory, but also marking the end of those large standing armies, because they swiftly demobilized right after those parades.
You say this is reminiscent of dictatorships, but Trump was apparently inspired by a Bastille Day parade that he saw in France, which is a Western liberal democracy.
Yeah.
If France can do it, why not the U.S.?
No, I mean, listen, there are other countries that are not part of that sort of access that do parades of this sort, but it's just sharply out of step with American history. Our country was born of a very particular opposition to state power, state authority, to standing armies, which could enforce that type of authority and power. And so even since the Cold War, with a large standing army intact, most presidents have shied away from these types of displays because they really run counter to the founding ideals. And it's hard to take this in isolation. One has to take it in tandem with other measures that the president has taken to really vastly expand the authority, the powers, and the deference accorded to the presidency. He's really reinventing the presidency as something that doesn't resemble what it has traditionally in American history, and the military parade is part of that.
We've been looking at some of the coverage of the parade that took place in 1991 at the end of the first Gulf War, and it's clear that it was very meaningful not just to troops who served in that war, but also to some Vietnam veterans. Here's a quote we found from a soldier named Captain Ben Clapsaddle. He was quoted in NPR's coverage.
I grew up in the 60s and 70s. My father was a Vietnam veteran, and the thousands of soldiers and service members that came home from that war didn't receive anything like this. I mean, this is a celebration for all the American people.
The people who served in the last two wars that the U.S. fought in Iraq and Afghanistan didn't get anything like this when those conflicts ended. And the Trump administration says this is about honoring all who served. What's wrong with having a parade like this to honor people who served in the military?
It really depends on how this parade is organized and ultimately what the message is behind it. The fact that it's being held on the president's birthday would suggest that this is less about them and more about him. I think that one can be forgiven for looking at this parade with a little bit of skepticism.
Joshua Zeitz is a contributing editor for Politico magazine and author most recently of Lincoln's God, How Faith Transformed a President and a Nation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Poland has a new president, far-right historian and amateur boxer Karol Nawrocki. He won by around a single percentage point in an election where voter turnout was high. NPR Central Europe correspondent Rob Schmitz explains what this will mean for a changing Europe.
Exuberance from the supporters of Karol Nawrocki after his narrow win over the center-left candidate Rafał Trzaskowski, who is close to Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk, a leader that many here on the right believe is pulling Poland in the wrong direction. We won't allow Donald Tusk's power to be all-encompassing so that the monopoly of evil power that does not care about public money takes away our dreams and robs us of our aspirations, said Nawrocki to his cheering supporters. The win for Karol Nawrocki, who belongs to Poland's far-right Law and Justice Party, was a surprise in an election when Rafał Trzaskowski, the pro-European Union multilingual mayor of Warsaw, led the polls throughout the campaign.
He managed to paint Trzaskowski as sort of anti-tradition, anti-religion, anti-church, leftist candidate.
Political analyst Jacek Kucharczyk says the surprise parliamentary defeat of Nawrocki's Law and Justice Party in 2023 after 8 years of governing Poland was cathartic for many liberals in Europe who feared rising populism and nationalism in the country. But now with this presidential victory for Law and Justice, he says it's clear that many Polish voters are still worried about creeping liberalism, watering down what they see as their national identity, a fear that is at play in elections throughout the world, he says.
Fear of migrants and fear that the society will change. The conviction that liberalized societies of Western Europe have made a mistake mainly by, introducing multiculturalism and so on and so forth.
Kucharczyk says many Poles who voted for Nawrocki were likely inspired by the victory of U.S. President Donald Trump. Poland has a close relationship with the United States, and President Trump received Nawrocki in a visit to the White House last month. Kucharczyk adds that Prime Minister Donald Tusk's government had been planning future policy on the assumption that its candidate, Rafał Trzaskowski, would win. But now, he says, those plans will have to be scrapped. He says Donald Tusk will continue to fight rising populism in Poland, but this election victory for Nawrocki will make it much more difficult. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
This is NPR News.
A Yale psychiatry researcher says that the very human desire to seek revenge could be more than just an impulse. It may be an addiction.
Your brain on revenge looks like your brain on drugs, and that's exactly what the brain scans show.
He says humans have been hardwired to seek revenge, but he also thinks there's a way to change your brain. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Red Cross says Israeli troops killed Palestinians going to a food distribution site in Gaza.
The Israeli military denies that report.
I urge you not to believe every rumor spread by Hamas. We will investigate each and one of those incidents.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The Supreme Court has declined to hear a major constitutional challenge to state laws in Maryland and Rhode Island that ban semi-automatic weapons like the AR-15 and the AK-47 used by the military. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports the court was split on whether to hear the case.
It takes the votes of four justices to grant review of a lower court decision. And in today's case, only the court's three most conservative justices, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch, voted to hear the appeal. Justice Kavanaugh, who declined to provide the fourth vote needed to hear the case next term, nonetheless filed a statement calling the lower court decision, quote, questionable. He gave no reason why he voted against hearing the case, except to say that there will be other similar cases before the court soon that, as he put it, should assist in making the ultimate decision on the AR-15. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
In New Jersey, Newark Liberty International Airport has a new runway that will soon be cleared for takeoff and landing. This comes after a recent shortage of air traffic controllers and a radar and telecom outage that led to huge delays and flight cancellations at Newark. Here's U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy.
Today we're celebrating the opening of Newark's runway. And this is a 60-day project that actually is completed 13 days early.
Duffy says the newly constructed runway still needs to be certified, and that process should take about a week. He also says we may see some of the same problems at other airports around the country, but Duffy says they will address those issues should they come up. On Wall Street, stocks finish modestly higher on Wall Street today. The Dow gained about 35 points. This is NPR News. Some healthy pregnant women, parents of healthy children, and healthy young adults are worried about the changes the Trump administration is making to the COVID-19 vaccines. NPR's Rob Stein has more on that story.
The Trump administration is no longer recommending the shots for healthy pregnant women, healthy children, or healthy adults younger than 65. That means it could be a lot harder for them to get protected against COVID. Lauren Capetti is 30 and lives in Cincinnati. She's about 5 months pregnant.
Why? Why? That's absolutely terrifying.
Competti and others will probably still be able to get vaccinated against COVID, but they'll have to find a doctor willing to prescribe the vaccine and pay for the shot themselves. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Well, the Disney movie Lilo and Stitch won the weekend box office draw for second week in a row, adding $63 million in domestic ticket sales, while the movie Sinners becomes the second highest grossing film of the year, earning more than $280 million so far. Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning came in third at the weekend box office, followed by Karate Kid Legends. Stocks finished higher on Wall Street today. The tech-heavy NASDAQ added 128 points, up about 0.7%. I'm Duane Brown. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. A deadly shooting in Gaza this weekend left at least 21 people dead and more than 150 wounded as they were seeking food, according to the International Committee of the Red Cross. Palestinian eyewitnesses say people were heading toward a new food distribution site when Israeli troops fired at them.
The U.S. ambassador for Israel says there was no such shooting and says U.S. media outlets reporting it are spreading, quote, utterly fabricated stories. Today, the Israeli military acknowledged its troops fired warning shots at Palestinians in a separate incident near the same food site. Gaza health officials say at least two were killed.
NPR's Daniel Estrin has more from Tel Aviv and a warning that this story describes graphic scenes of violence.
NPR spoke with two Palestinians who said they survived a terrifying few hours early Sunday morning in Gaza. Mohammed Sakab, a father of three, told NPR producer Ahmed Abu Hamda he took a horse-drawn cart to the seashore at 2 a.m. and joined huge crowds hoping to reach a food distribution site when it opened at 6 a.m. He had heard supplies run out quickly. The Israeli military began firing warning shots from tanks and navy boats, he says, while drones played an announcement ordering crowds to retreat. People dropped on their stomachs to take cover, but they'd advance little by little. It was dark. He says he kept hearing shots and people screaming. There was an old woman near him with her grandson. She was shot in the neck. I found her full of blood, he says, as her grandson shouted, "Oh, grandma, oh, grandma." NPR spoke with another man who says he was in the crowd, named Barakat. He asked that his last name be withheld, fearing repercussions from Israel. He said Navy boats opened fire, and he described similar scenes. This is inhumane, unsafe, and unfair, Barakat said. He says he went home empty-handed. Everyone had already grabbed all the food. Speaking anonymously in line with military protocol, an Israeli military official told media outlets, including NPR, that troops did fire warning shots at, quote, suspects about 1,000 yards from the food site. The official said it was to prevent them from approaching troops. But publicly, Israeli military spokesman Effie Defrin released this video message.
I urge you not to believe every rumor spread by Hamas. We will investigate each and one of those incidents and each and one of those allegations.
The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF, the U.S.-backed group running the new food site, issued denials. It said no civilians were shot near the site and sent emails saying NPR's accounts were completely false and ludicrous. U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee also weighed in. He says U.S. media reports of shooting are false and that first-hand accounts showed no injuries, no fatalities, no shooting. He accused U.S. media outlets of contributing to an anti-Semitic climate that resulted in Sunday's attack on pro-Israel demonstrators in Boulder, Colorado. In Gaza, the big picture aid workers say is that not enough people are getting food. None has reached North Gaza in more than 3 months. The World Food Program keeps trying to deliver flour there, but their trucks have been looted, says the WFP's Corinne Fleischer.
When there is no food in a place where 2.1 million people live, of course criminality increases dramatically. People just try to get their hands on whatever they can.
She says what's needed now is a ceasefire. She says that is the best way to get food to people in Gaza safely. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Meta is planning to replace humans with artificial intelligence to assess the risks of its products. That's according to internal Meta documents obtained by NPR and interviews with current and former Meta employees. And I'll note, Meta is a financial sponsor of NPR. NPR's Bobby Allen broke the story. He joins us now. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Bobby, tell us, what exactly do those documents that you've obtained have to say?
Yeah, they describe a push inside Meta to automate more systems. But what's really interesting about them is what exactly is being automated. And it's a process for reviewing the privacy and risks of updates to Instagram, WhatsApp, and Facebook. For years, Meta has studied every change and update to its apps with, you know, teams of hundreds of risk assessors looking at questions like, okay, could this violate someone's privacy? Could this cause harm to minors? Could it change, worsen the spread of misleading or toxic content? And documents obtained by my colleague Shannon Bond and I show that 90% of these assessments will soon be moved to a new system powered by AI instead of being debated by a group of human reviewers.
So, I mean, is this just another story about automation with AI replacing human jobs? Or, Bobby, is there something a bit different about what is happening inside Meta?
Yeah, AI is being ramped up across many parts of Meta, from how it moderates content to how its advertising business works. And sometimes that will mean a machine will be doing part or all of a task previously done by humans. But the reason why this particular change is so controversial is because it involves really sensitive and tricky determinations, right? Evaluating the societal impact of a Meta product. Now, product developers inside Meta are thrilled about this, since it means they could move faster and update Meta's products for its billions of users. But, you know, Shannon and I talked to former Meta executives who wonder at what cost. Some of these former Meta employees say this new system could mean more Meta products causing problems in the world are less likely to be prevented now.
Okay, and what has Meta had to say about your reporting?
Yeah, Meta told us in a statement that this new AI system is supposed to focus on low-risk decisions and that really complex issues will still be handled by humans. But I will say the internal documents we reviewed show that Meta is considering automating risk reviews for areas including AI safety, youth risk, and a category that includes things like violent content and whether Meta's apps are amplifying the spread of falsehoods.
If we can, Bobby, I just want to zoom out for a moment. How do these changes fit into the larger shifts we've been tracking at Meta over the last year?
Yeah, this new system was first announced to employees not long after Meta ended its fact-checking program and loosened its hate speech policies. These changes happened as CEO Mark Zuckerberg has been appealing to President Trump. Zuckerberg called Trump's election victory a cultural tipping point, and he has met several times with the president since he's been elected. You know, what we're seeing more and more at Meta is a new emphasis on unmoderated, unrestrained speech across its platforms and, you know, a push to try to move, you know, try to update its apps more rapidly. And current and former employees say it represents a dismantling of various guardrails that were enacted over the years that were stood up to try to curb the misuse and abuse of its platforms.
NPR's Bobby Allen, thank you so much.
Thanks, Juana.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Now, a story about a woman with an unfulfilled dream and a volunteer nearby with a lot of joy to share. KUER's Ciara Hewlett has the story of how they got together.
Elaine Worth loves sports cars. She used to own a Thunderbird and lately has wanted a red convertible Mustang. But she's 76 and after a few strokes can no longer drive. Now, on a Saturday outside her retirement home, one pulls up.
Whoa! Wow.
Mom, you get to go ride in this Mustang.
Legacy House in Spanish Fork, Utah has a new bucket list program to make residents' wishes come true with the help of the community. Marketing director Emma Sorensen put this surprise together.
People have this idea that
they move into an assisted living and their story's ending, when in reality it's just another beginning of a cool and amazing chapter of their story.
Once Worth's seatbelt is on, the spunky grandma blows kisses to her family. She's ready to party in the convertible, wearing red, white, and blue clothes. She's delighted by the purr of the engine.
Listen to that music. Yes, yes, yes.
Sandra Lamb owns the Mustang and volunteered for this as fast as she could.
This is a golden girl moment.
Yeah, that's true.
Lamb's dad died 2 years ago, but she remembers taking him out for rides in this convertible.
So I pull up in my dad's driveway and I said, "Dad, you want to go topless today?" And he'd laugh and laugh, and we'd get in the car and he went for his topless ride.
Oh, he got to go. So
Lamb bought this car for herself after she was diagnosed with breast cancer.
It was the color red of love and happiness. And so I just finished my treatment actually about 3 months ago, and I am good to go. So it's a celebration for me too.
And Lamb says it makes her happy to share the joy.
That's why the door's open. You can come call me for a ride anytime.
Okay. Thank you.
I expect a phone call.
But the ride isn't over yet.
Hi, what can I get for you?
Can I get 4 small ice cream cones in a cup?
Lamb used to get ice cream with her dad every time she took him out for a ride.
It's yummy.
Worth says she's going to brag to her friends at Legacy House.
I'm going to say, well, I can die now. I'm happy and I've had a nice, nice ride.
And she's proving that it's never too late to live a dream. For NPR News, I'm Ciara Hewlett in Spanish Fork, Utah.
The first American pope, Leo XIV, was raised in Chicago, but there's another city that claims him too, New Orleans.
We call him our cousin.
His brothers look like my dad's side of the family.
I'm wondering if I'm related to the pope.
Pope Leo's Creole roots and what his papacy means to Black Catholics. Come back tomorrow for that story on All Things Considered.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. For years, Kash Patel was a fierce critic of the FBI. He once said he would close FBI headquarters on day one and turn it into a museum of the deep state. Well, Patel is now the director of the very agency he once criticized. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas has been digging in to what Patel has done at the Bureau since taking over. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
So, Ryan, if I'm counting correctly, Kash Patel's been in the job for more than 100 days at this point. So tell us what you've been hearing about his tenure as the FBI director.
Right. So this is important in part because Patel has no prior experience leading anything like the FBI, and this is a huge job. So I spoke with several current and former FBI officials to get a sense of how Patel is leading the Bureau. And first off, he has a very different leadership style from his predecessors. Previous directors were very buttoned up. They spoke in measured tones. His immediate predecessors, of course, didn't try to make a splash on social media. Patel, in contrast, pushes out flashy videos or photos on social media. There's one of them where he's wearing camouflage and sunglasses as he watches an FBI training exercise, for example. Now, he's also gone to NHL games and hobnobbed with hockey legend Wayne Gretzky. He sat ringside for UFC fights in Miami and Las Vegas. One former senior FBI official told me that sort of hobnobbing, it's not a good look for FBI director. For some FBI folks, there's also a sense that there's a lot of work on the director's plate and that Patel should be working and not sitting in luxury boxes.
Interesting. Okay, so that's his leadership style, but tell us about any substantive changes that he's made so far at the Bureau.
Well, there are a couple of things. He's begun transferring people out of headquarters in Washington, D.C. and redeploying them around the country. Patel has put the number publicly to be around 1,500 people, so that's about 10% of FBI folks in the D.C. area. Some of them are going to the FBI's big campus in Huntsville, Alabama. Others are going to field offices across the nation. And Patel talked about this when he was on the Hill last month. Here's a bit of what he said.
We need their expertise in your states, in your counties, in your towns, because the threat to this country in 2025 is everywhere, and we cannot quarterback that mission from Washington, D.C. alone.
Now, the former FBI folks I've spoken to are generally supportive of this plan. They say it's something that has been under consideration for a long time. They say that headquarters in Washington has grown too large, too cumbersome. On the other hand, a number of senior FBI officials have been pushed out under the Trump administration. These are people with decades of experience. So the Bureau's lost a lot of knowledge, a lot of expertise, which matters now because neither Patel nor his deputy have any experience in the FBI.
Well, what about the FBI's priorities, Ryan? Have they changed at all under Patel?
Well, look, there's a ton of stuff that falls to the FBI to investigate. We're talking foreign spies, terrorists, bank robbers, hackers, white-collar criminals. Patel has said for his priorities, crushing violent crime and defending the homeland are two of his top ones. That's how Patel's put it. But the primary change really appears to be a shift in focus to immigration enforcement, which isn't a typical FBI mission. Immigration, though, we know, is a major policy focus for the Trump administration. I'm told most, if not all, FBI field offices are now working on immigration enforcement. The push is to do this 7 days a week. Former FBI officials say there are likely ripple effects to this because the FBI, of course, only has a finite amount of resources. So if you're putting agents on immigration, you're taking them off of something else, and that could be things like counterintelligence and counterterrorism.
The Justice Department under President Trump is focusing less on white-collar crime. I wonder, is that the case for the FBI, too?
It is, yes. And as part of that, Patel has disbanded the FBI's premier public corruption squad, which was part of the Washington field office. This was a unit that was involved in investigating Trump himself. One former senior FBI official I spoke with called this decision baffling. This person said only the FBI does these sorts of corruption probes into public officials. Sir, if they're not doing it, who is? But at the same time, the new FBI deputy director, former podcaster Dan Bongino, he said last week that the FBI would pour resources into what he called three potential cases of public corruption: the January 6th D.C. pipe bombs, the discovery of a small bag of cocaine at the White House in 2023, and the leak of the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision that overturned Roe v. Wade, all of which, I will note, were previously investigated during the Biden administration.
NPR's Ryan Lucas, thank you.
Thank you.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Amy Connor. In February 2003, Connor went into labor. She was pregnant with twin boys, William and James, but it was a full 10 weeks before her due date. After the birth, the twins were put in the neonatal intensive care unit. Both boys were struggling, and James needed a blood transfusion, but the hospital didn't have any blood that matched.
without it, he might die. So they put out the call, obviously, probably, I think, through the Red Cross, and they told us that we could also put out the call for people to come and donate for James. We sent out emails to all of our friends and family, but, you know, sitting there and waiting to find out if your child is going to get something that they need to live or die it's sort of surreal. I've never experienced anything like that before, or again, thank God. The hospital told us that they had never had so many people show up to donate for a single person. I think the number was 29 people showed up in 24 hours to donate blood for James. And in all of those people, one of them was a match. When they came back and told us that there was one match out of all of those, it's not even just a sigh of relief. It's like you release all of this breath in your body that you didn't even know you were holding. And so James was able to get the blood that he needed. Because of HIPAA laws, everything is, I don't want to say secret, but private. And we'll never know who the match was for James. And the person who donated will never know that they were the match either. So somewhere out there in the world is somebody who saved my son's life, and I will never know them. If I had them in front of me and I could thank them, what I would say is this one little act that took them probably, I don't know, half an hour or an hour out of their lives changed so many people's lives. They are solely responsible for the fact that he lived and the fact that he has grown up and that he will someday have a family. I don't think there are words to say thank you enough for something like that. So my unsung hero will always be unsung.
That's Amy Connor of Northport, New York. James and his brother William are 22 years old now and thriving. James loves running marathons and is looking forward to graduating college in December. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org.
Well, I was born on a chicken farm near Mashville, Tennessee. There was nobody there but a sky full of air, 17 million chickens and me. Then one fine day I said, hey, I think I'll drop a little LSD. Well, it blew my mind and I got so kind that I set my chickens free. There was chickens in the cabbages, chickens in the corn, chickens in the cauliflower, chickens in the barn, chickens driving Cadillacs to Washington, D.C. when I set my chickens free. Country full of chickens.